for those who know every line, and for those finding Star Wars for the very first time, welcome to Growing Up Skywalker.
Welcome to Growing Up Skywalker. I'm Sam.
Hi, I'm Anna.
And today we are finishing up Solo.
What, Sam, is our gang of pirate, hustler, thieves doing in the second half of Solo?
So we left with the Solo gang getting together everything they needed. They finally got a ship, however, it was impounded. And now it is unimpounded, totally legally-ish. And they are flying off being tracked by Enfys Nest.
So they're making their way to Kessel for unrefined coaxium so that they can pay off their massive debt to Dryden Vos, who is the leader of Crimson Dawn.
So while Beckett and Chewie play Dejarik and L3 and Lando are flying, Han goes into the Cape Room and makes out with Kira, talking about the plan, but are interrupted because they have a plan that they need to put together.
So for those who are watching with us, the timestamps for where we're picking up is about an hour and 3 minutes in. We were gonna hit Ixnay last week at the smooch scene in the cape closet, and I'm glad we did not do that because it's great and I love it.
So Han is pulled aside to do planning. L3 and Kira have a very funny conversation about men. What is their deal? Because she can tell when men are in love. L3 has sensors that can tell when men are in love with them. And so Lando is in love with L3 and Han is in love with Kira.
I completely buy this. They are totally right. What I wouldn't give to be in on that girl goss sesh.
So this is a precision job. They have to get to the thermal vault. They land. Kira is completely done up as Oksana Florin, the fast-talking subsecretary to the superintendent, assistant to the regional manager, just fast-talks her way in by saying, we will give you slaves. And who's her slaves? It's Han and Chewie done up in binders, and they're being guarded by Beckett wearing a big, creepy mask. So the slaves are brought down below, and the other guys are brought to the main control room. So we've got L3 translating. We've got Kira with L3 with the big boss of the mining facility and Beckett in the control room when it is time for the action sequence. Simultaneously, Han and Chewie defeat their guards in the elevator and blow out the camera. The droids in the control room start chittering wildly, and L3 is watching as Kira disembowels, apparently, the guard. She just sits there and goes, whoa. Apparently it's called Teres Kasi, which Kira explains later, and Beckett shoots all the guards in the control room. So now the control room is under control of the good guys, and Han and Chewie put on a costume and start moving down to take over the coaxium.
Importantly, L3 takes off the restraining bolt from an astromech droid who then frees the entire colony. So all of this action scene is taking place in the middle of a slave revolt.
The droids are going crazy, just saying freedom, freedom, and releasing everything. So it's pure chaos. Lando is in the ship dictating his memoirs. He's like, hey, what are you guys doing in there? Because there's a full-on revolt going on. Han and Chewie are running along, and Chewie sees a bunch of other Wookiees and runs off to go help them. So Han is alone, wearing a very large pike outfit. He finally gets to the vault, and he fast talks close enough to a guard to just kick him in the nads and stab him in the face.
Would you say he is Han Solo?
As Chewie
side quests?
So Han grabs the 12, apparently 200-pound, big old oxygen canister-sized tanks of coaxium and is pushing them with a cart. He's about to get surrounded by guards because the guards have twigged onto everything now. There's a shootout in the control room when Chewbacca and a bunch of other Wookiees show up.
Like avenging gods.
And they just beat the crap out of everyone.
They just whoop some pike butt.
You don't get to see a lot of people get really beat up in Star Wars movies, unless a Wookiee's doing it, where they just grab someone by the leg and slam them into the ceiling and then slam them into the floor like an Italian mom with spaghetti. It is unbelievable.
And then all the Wookiees just form this honor guard of pure muscle around this card of coaxium, and they just push it like a overloaded Costco shopping cart through a revolt.
So this revolt is ongoing, but the guards have twigged onto everything. All the good guys are making their way back to the ship, loading everything on. It's completely crazy. Lando comes out and is shooting and says, where's L3? L3 is leading a revolt, a rebellion for freedom. She gets shot once in the shoulder, once right through her center mass, and goes down. Lando drops everything and runs to her, picks her up, only gets the top half, and starts bringing her back as she is undergoing hard blue screen of death, problematic reboots.
Han and Chewie have to rescue them both, and then Kira has to come hooping and hollering out of the Falcon, and she's lobbing grenades everywhere.
It's so funny because as soon as they get back to the ship, Kira is like immediately runs inside, throws down her Oksana cape, and disappears. And then she comes back right when the good guys need her and throws as hard as she can these grenades. And when they land, the entire hillside explodes. Apparently she was holding like thermal detonators or something in her wardrobe, in her other boots.
My favorite moment in this movie is that she claps in their faces and says, come on, boys, what are we standing around for? Let's go, let's go.
Inside, Lando's been shot. He can't fly. Beckett says, Han, let's go. Han turns to Lando. Lando gestures at the cockpit. Han jumps in the cockpit, gives a little smile, and takes off. As they're flying out, they start heading along the beacons. Kira in the co-pilot seat, Chewbacca right behind her. When out of the lightning in this hole, because that's what the mail, like this nebula has holes, like worm tunnels through it, and barely clearing the edges is an Imperial Star Destroyer. This is the first time we've actually seen an Imperial class Star Destroyer just bearing down on them. That is an Imperial blockade. Lando is like, there is no way out of this. We need to dump the cargo. Han says, oh yeah, watch this. Pulls a hard handbrake U-turn and runs off and then punches through into unbeaconed, just nebula territory full of snow and ice and carbonbergs being chased by TIE fighters. Just full YOLO at this moment. As they're flying along, Beckett ducks down, gets on the rear guns, starts blasting. One of the TIE fighters gets past them and Han just bedoinks it into an asteroid and it explodes. They're flying along. They're being chased by one last one. Han says, I'm going to pull this street racer trick that the best street racer in Corellia did before he died doing this trick. And does a, like, he puts the gear down and skids out on this big asteroid to brush up enough gravel to just puncture the windscreen of the TIE fighter that's following them. They take off. Chewie is just barely flying. They cut just in time around this thing, and they are flying along. Meanwhile, they still don't have a way out.
Also, the coaxium is getting hotter and hotter in its little stowhold.
It is ripe, according to Beckett.
Gross.
So the plan is they don't have L3. So Han says, plug L3 into the ship's Nava computer, and that is what Kira and Lando are working on. They get her plugged in and they find out where they are. They're going to have to fly along real close to the Maw.
So they're in the Maw, and they're about to be swallowed by a space squid.
Which they realize when they turn the lights on, they're all jump scared. They're flying past this, it's probably 5 miles in diameter, this enormous space cuttlefish with literally a billion eyes. It is an eldritch horror from beyond comprehension that is about to eat them. They're flying along when they come to the Maw, which is an enormous gravity well, a black hole, a big whirlpool. They're being chased. Han flies right up to it and then yeets out the escape craft, cuts his engines and flies the opposite direction, which pulls the creature into the black hole. But they got too close and they can't escape.
So they decide to put a singular drop of raw coaxium into the fusion reactor to get a little extra kick. It's like putting lava in your soup for seasoning.
Apparently, Beckett is in charge of that task because he's got the steadiest hands and nothing else to do. So he's running around the ship with like a freaking needle, like an insulin needle full of raw fusion fuel. He even like protects it with his body as the ship shudders and he has to take a fall and just like skids along the ground. He gets it in. It's just a ting as the window is getting narrower and narrower and narrower. They have to point out. They line up just perfectly. They call out the countdown. They punch it. The engines go out. They start tumbling back towards the black hole when the engines kick right back on. Star Wars theme intensifies.
Breaking the sound barrier.
They leave treadmarks in space as they make it through this narrow closing canyon. And just like at the very beginning of the movie, they turn sideways. Kira's like, but that didn't work. And Han says, this time it will. They cut to light speed just in time to fly out of the maelstrom.
Importantly, Han's streetcar racing maneuver got their landing gear blown off. So they crash land on Savarine like a saucer with no bottom.
And they unload everything. Han is in high spirits, just did the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs.
And the Savarine, you know, cargo loader guy is like, literally, whatever. And Chewie's like, you didn't even do it in 12. You rounded down.
So
I feel like we should specify they're on Savarine to refine the unrefined coaxium.
Yep.
I straight up don't know how that works, and I feel like Sam knows too much about how that works, so we're gonna just skip straight through that.
Apparently you can do it in like a dusty, worn out pile of junk town, so I don't know what you need to do it, but you can't fit on the Millennium Falcon, but there
yeah.
you go.
You know, I love that for them.
So they show up, Kira and Han are having a talk, and he's like, hey, this is a wildly successful job, you should come with me. And she's like, no, I'm bad, and you are actually good. And he's like, I'm not good. I'm an outlaw. I'm cool. I'm a scoundrel. Definitely not a good guy. But they come outside, and who is waiting for them but Enfys Nest and all the Cloud Riders?
Importantly, Lando sees what's going on and GTFOs.
Because Han tries to bluff and say that ship is full of 30 hired guns and there's only like 12 Cloud Riders. But then Lando uses that exact moment to fly off. So now there's a standoff. Enfys Nest takes off their mask and reveals a teenage? Early 20s?
Like 17 years old, kind of cool looking kid.
Yeah, a woman who is just walks to the bar, I need a drink, because they realize they're in this terrible standoff right now. Dryden Vos is going to show up and be expecting the coaxium. And he's in his massive yacht. He's got as many hired guns as he needs. But Enfys Nest says, these people on this planet, the reason they haven't said anything on all of Savarine is because their tongues were cut out by the Crimson Dawn, because these people didn't want to be slaves to Crimson Dawn anymore.
Also, she explains that her mom was the leader of the Cloud Fighters. And they're a group of freedom fighters, and they're pushing back against all of the five syndicates mm-hmm. who have just been ripping resources out of their planets. And she wants the coaxium to fund the war.
And use it to fight the Empire, because the syndicates and the Empire work together.
And Han is like, I'm all in.
So Han goes off and talks to Beckett and says, all right, here's the plan. And he says, we need to give this coaxium to Enfys Nest. So what we'll do is we'll come up with some sort of plan. We cut off screen to Enfys Nest and Kira talking together, watching in the distance Han and Beckett talking together. And they say, Han's going to convince Beckett to be part of our plan. But Beckett says, you got to know when to hold him and when to fold him. And I'm folding. I'm walking.
So Kira, Han, and Chewie go to face Dryden on his yacht alone,
carrying a big cooler full of coaxium, refined coaxium now.
And Dryden has got his little canapes, his lobster claw, his shrimp cocktail.
So it's actually Colo Claw, which is the bigger fish from Phantom Menace.
You gotta be kidding me.
No.
The Easter eggs keep coming.
And so Dryden is like, oh, how delightful, how wonderful that you've delivered. Come sit next to me. In fact, why don't you hand me one of those coaxium tubes? And Han's like, this is like crazy explosive. And Dryden's like, hand it to me. I'd never ask for anything twice.
Everyone's sweating.
Han hands him a bunch of coaxium, and Dryden says, "It's simply magnificent how you made a fake.
It looks just like the real thing. Too bad my associate already told me that you're trying to swindle me out of everything I own."
So now the situation is Kira has betrayed Dryden. Dryden doesn't know what to do with Kira. And Beckett has rolled in and been like, "Yeah, I called you out. I told Dryden that you guys would be bringing fakes."
He crossed him. He double crossed him.
And right then, all of the goons, the Black Sun goons, show up and take over the village. And they've got Enfys Nest down in front of them with guns.
Importantly, Beckett says, "Han, you weren't paying attention. I told you a million times. Everyone will betray you." And then Han says, "Joke's on you. I was paying attention. You said people are predictable, and you are no exception."
So the Enfys Nest in the city takes off her helmet to reveal it is a little old lady, and the actual Enfys Nest jumps off a roof with her electro stave and proceeds to beat all of the Black Sun guards. And right then, Beckett pulls out his gun, shoots the guards in Dryden Voss's room and says, "I'm thinking about what to do with this 60 million credits worth of coaxium, and I prefer to be the only one with a gun when I'm thinking."
It turns out all the canisters with Enfys Nest are empty. The real coaxium is there in the room with them. It's a triple cross.
And so Beckett and Chewie leave with the coaxium. And as soon as the door closes, Han reaches for his blaster that was hidden inside the cooler lid. And Dryden reaches for his knives he used to kill the regional governor. And they are in a shootout in this extremely fancy room. It's a pretty rough fight. And right as Han is about to get beat up, Kira comes out of nowhere with a sword and beats Han down.
She holds the point of the sword to Han's chest. She says, "Don't take it personally. This is what I was taught. Find a person's weakness and use it against them. And today, Dryden Voss, I am your weakness."
Because he was walking up behind her to watch her kill Han as a show of her loyalty. She swings around. She chops at him. She chops at him again. He stabs down with his blade and she catches it with the tip of her sword and then uses his double-bladed blade as a hammer to stab him in the chest.
It is the single most incredible thing I have ever seen.
And then she says, "Great work. We solved all the problems. I'm coming with you, but I'm going to loot the room first. Go save Chewie." And she goes and she doesn't loot the room, which has conveniently jewels and gems everywhere. She loots the corpse. She loots Dryden's signet ring and goes to make a call.
She calls
Dryden Voss's boss, Maul.
She has decided not to spend her life with Han, not to take the clean getaway, but to become the new leader of Crimson Dawn.
And Maul is extremely threatening, turns on his lightsaber and says, "We'll be working much more closely in the future.
Come to Dathomir and we'll figure out what to do."
Meanwhile, Han shows up at the path that Beckett was taking, presumably to their emergency backup ship. He's got his gun. Chewie's hauling the crates of coaxium. And Beckett says, "Ah, Dryden dead?" Han says, "Yep. Kira killer? Yes. Interesting." And Beckett says, "Yeah, that's the game," as they watch Kira fly off.
And then Beckett's hands are twitching toward his gun when Han takes him out with a shot to the chest.
Right as Beckett is saying, "I got one last lesson to teach you," Han shoots him right in the chest, takes him down, and then cradles in his arms. And Beckett's like, "Hey, good move. I was gonna kill you." And then he dies.
And then they watch Kira lift off in her new yacht. They both betrayed Han. Mm-hmm. His mentor is dead. His girlfriend left him. It's just him and Chewie.
So he goes back to Enfys Nest. They've refined all the coaxium. They're putting it in the big crates. But Enfys Nest says, "Hey, we're having a little bit of a rebellion party. Do you want to join?" Han says, "No, not for me." But Enfys Nest hands him one little container, just like the one at the very beginning, of coaxium.
And then they go to hunt down Lando.
So flash forward an indeterminate amount of time. on some jungle planet with fun music playing, listening to Lando just schmoozing and winning at cards. Here comes Han. Han comes in and is like, I can't believe you betrayed us. You're cut. You're cut left with you. Like, you are gone. And as he sees Han with Han's hands up, he sees the skifter on Han's wrist.
It's the little wrist rocket that shoots him the green Psylop card.
So Han goes in for a big hug and then uses the canister of coaxium worth apparently 20,000 creds as a stake in for a game. We flash forward a little bit. The game's down to the all-in stage. He's putting the Millennium Falcon on the line. Han Solo says, I call. And then Lando reaches down and, you know, has like a little hiccup, a little burp. His arm's down there. You got everything you need, buddy? Yeah, yeah. Lando puts down his hand. It's pretty good. Not good enough. And then Han puts down the card that was in up Lando's sleeve.
A little green Psylop.
You would have won except for this. And they take the Millennium Falcon and fly off for adventure. And there's a big time gangster on Tatooine looking for a crew to put together.
He's putting together a job.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if his name is Jabba the Hutt.
And that is Solo, the thrilling conclusion.
This was the longest plot summary in the history of the world because this movie is great and you just cannot skip the little grace notes, the little details. Everything is working towards something.
The plot is really convoluted. Like, the first half of the movie is getting together the crew, getting the ship, making it happen. And then the second half is, this is what happens. And it's surprisingly quick.
I actually think the plot is really clean.
Mm.
Anyway, we can definitely talk about it. I have to put it out there up front. I cannot express how much I love this movie. There are not words. This movie made me feral. It gives me Star Wars fever. I want to watch it again. I want to rent out a movie theater with all of my friends and make them watch it. I want a sequel. I want to play Outer Rim. I want to read comic books. I want to know what Han and Chewie are up to. I want to know everything else I'm missing out on in Star Wars.
After watching this last night, Anna's like, let's play Outer Rim. And it's like after 8 and it's a 3-hour game. So it's like, maybe tomorrow.
I think Solo is the first Star Wars content that I have watched in 2 years of doing this every week that makes me think, we are not moving fast enough. I want to know what happens next. What else is out there? What am I missing?
Mm.
Ah!
And it's funny because due to Star Wars fatigue, coming only 5 months after The Last Jedi and after Rogue One, it was a flop. Not to mention that the building was cursed. They ended up having to reshoot like 3/4 of it. It was a really complicated movie to make. It lost a bunch of money, and it was basically the last movie except for the finishing of the sequels.
We got a lot of really interesting comments on social media this week. A lot of people pointed out even further reasons why Solo flopped in the theaters.
Mm-hmm.
It came out the same weekend as Avengers Endgame.
It did, yeah.
Can you imagine making your Star Wars movie premiere on the same day as the final Avengers movie?
And what's really annoying about that is that Disney owns both. Disney did a bad job with this.
The coordination is not difficult.
No.
Do not put out your blockbuster movie on the same day as your other blockbuster movie. Come on, folks.
Yeah.
I don't even work in film marketing and I know that.
But this movie has been a critical and fan fave for a while. It's well regarded. It's just the nature of movies, particularly in that slight gap we had before the pandemic, because now everything is streaming, everything's completely different. But back then, you lived and died in the movie theater, and it died there.
So I want to do something a little bit fun, a little bit different. Mm-hmm. I work with researchers, and I just was working on this big research conference, and the researchers had this interesting thing that they did for audience participation, right? They would put a provocative statement on the screen to spur people's thoughts and opinions about what they were talking about. So I have a provocative statement about Solo for you.
What's that?
And I want you to react to it.
Okay.
Provocative statement, : Solo is the first Star Wars movie a brand new fan should watch.
Ooh, that's interesting. So maybe. I think if you are an adult.
Hmm.
I think that kids would have more fun with the prequels.
Interesting.
Pod racing is more fun. And
more fun than a space heist?
Yes. And then, so what you... How would you watch it then? You'd watch Solo and then the original trilogy? You'd watch Solo, then Rogue One, then the original trilogy?
Okay, so here's my thinking. And I know this is wildly controversial because I'm a big fan of the in-universe chronology. Start with the prequels, move to the original trilogy, etc. That's what I'm doing as a new fan. I think it's really effective. But I will say that you as a veteran fan had to hook me with something to even get me interested enough in the prequels to watch them. And you used Mando because you correctly decided that Grogu would be the correct hook.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am saying I think Solo is another correct hook for a new fan.
I think that is very viable. It captures a really fun Star Wars vibe. And I'm reminded of something in the Rogue Squadron books that I read recently, which was in the early books, a couple of X-Wings taking down a Star Destroyer would be like a big deal. And then in the later books, they're like, oh, yeah, everyone's painting Star Destroyers on their hulls. Like, that's just the rite of passage. And so you need to escalate things. The Millennium Falcon taking on 4 TIE line fighters and 1 TIE Brute, and that being a tough fight is interesting.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking that even though there are no Jedi and no Force in this movie, you level set for the amount of work and effort it takes to defeat something like a TIE fighter. And then you go back and you watch The Phantom Menace, for example, and you're like, whoa, these Jedi are amazing.
And it helps rehabilitate stormtroopers, which are supposedly the elites amongst the Imperial Army. And when we see Han Solo as an Imperial Army grunt on Mimban, just like, yes, my life sucks. I have a laser. I just run forward. I don't know. And a stormtrooper is actually like organized. That makes them a little bit scarier, which makes the events of A New Hope better.
So what watching Solo first would not do is maybe give you any perspective about why we're here, what the Empire is, what's going on. So, like, I don't think it's an airtight argument, but I think if you need a hook, if you need to dangle some bait in front of someone, I mean, this is like Star Wars candy.
So here is another big problem. And we talked about it a little bit last episode because we buried the lead a little bit with Maul actually being the leader of the Crimson Dawn.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
And so for me, a big incentive to get people to watch the Clone Wars is, do you want the ending of Solo to make sense? Because if you start with Solo and then you're like, oh, okay, so apparently the crime boss is this huge dude. And then you watch Phantom Menace sometime in the future and you're like, oh, okay, Darth Maul. Oh, that's weird. He got cut in half. And then you have to watch all Clone Wars to learn, okay, he got better, and then he got a lot better, and then he got real scary, and then events ensued, like 7 to 10 years in between the events of season 7 and now, and he's running the Black Sun now, and that is a black hole of canonicity as well.
Mm.
So when I went, I saw it with my family, and they had watched all the Star Wars movies. They're that level of fan, but none of them had watched the TV shows. And they're like, why is Darth Maul still alive? Is this like really old? Is this before Phantom Menace?
Ooh.
They didn't understand. And so that's a complication. But if this is the first movie you see, I think it'd be a good one.
One other thing that I love about this movie is that you can hardly keep track of the double and triple crosses in this movie. People's loyalties are flip-flopping like a sandal shop. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so perfect because this movie is about outlaws. These characters have principles, but their principles are like, make money,
mm-hmm.
get out alive, don't be anybody's Huckleberry. They're not Jedi, right? Like, they're not living by a code enforced by the Force, right? And I think it's so interesting to watch and try to suss out what each character's moral code actually is.
Yeah, it really focuses on Han's. As they're taking the elevator up to deliver the coaxium to Dryden Voss, Han says, "We're gonna win." And Kira says, "This isn't the kind of game you win. It's the kind of game you keep playing to stay in."
I think that dialogue is incredible.
And it's a funny thing because they are criminals and they do what's called the Kansas City Shuffle. in the Order of the Stick webcomic, they talk about it as like the point of a shell game is that the ball is always in the con man's hand. It's not underneath any of the cups.
Oh.
And that's what the con they're running on Dryden is. They tell Beckett the plan so that Beckett will tell Dryden Voss, so that they can lie to Dryden Voss and get him off kilter. Now, where the plan goes awry is, I don't think they planned like to succeed that hard. And then Kira and Han, Kira's standing over him holding a sword, and presumably Kira was like, oh yeah, I'll let you two kill each other, not telling Han that she is going to pretend to be ready to kill him to show her loyalty, and then use that to give herself a promotion by killing Dryden.
Oh, I actually read all of that so differently.
What was your read?
My read is that Han went to Beckett in good faith mm-hmm. and said, I'm all in. You should be all in. Let's do this together. I need my partner. And then when he saw Beckett walk off, he wasn't expecting that. And he thought to himself, oh, he's not going to go learn to play the Valacord and pay off his debts. He is going to go to Dryden Voss. And I thought the double and triple crossing like really started there. I think Han was legitimately in good faith going to bring Beckett into the plan, and they were going to do it together. But that's when Han's second instinct kicked in, and he realized all of the different ripples of the double crossing that would have to happen.
I think Han knew he couldn't get Beckett on board with giving the coaxium to Enfys Nest and the Cloud Riders.
Interesting.
Yeah. I've watched this movie a bunch of times because it's fantastic. This is if I walked into like a restaurant and they were playing this movie, I would watch it the whole way through.
Buy dinner and dessert
yeah.
and a couple of drinks and sit there and watch the whole thing.
Yeah. This is a stop everything you're doing and watch this movie because it's fantastic.
This movie slaps. Interesting. I really thought that they were all sort of improvising the whole thing through. I think that Dryden had his initial double cross set up and Han had his initial double cross set up. And then they were all improvising around each other the whole time. You think it was all premeditated?
I think it was.
Oh.
Because there's this line, and it's very funny that this whole thing is basically... So in 1977, when A New Hope comes out, freaking Luke and Obi-Wan Kenobi are asking this scruffy nerf herder about how fast his ship is. And he says, fast? You've never heard of the Millennium Falcon? It's the ship that made the Kessel Run in 12 parsecs. And people in 1977 didn't know what a parsec was. People today don't know what a parsec is. I'm happy to explain it to you on social media.
Hand raised. I don't know what a parsec is.
Well, it depends on Earth. It's a triangle. It's a hypotenuse triangle, and the short leg is one astronomical unit.
Okay.
And so if you're assuming Earth, it's about 3¼ parsecs. Or okay. Sorry, 3¼ light years.
My eyes are dangerously close to glazing over. Yes. How does this relate to Obi-Wan and Luke?
So people were like, less than 12 parsecs, that's not a unit of time. That's a unit of distance. And that doesn't make any sense. And so now this movie explains how it all works together, that you actually just need to find a shorter route through this really complicated thing. And then we get to, is Han a BSer or is he actually that good?
Oh.
And the answer is yes.
It's the Lando question, but flip-flop.
It is. Lando is like that good, but also BSing. Han is BSing, but also that good.
Yes.
And so... when he lands on Savareen and says, not if you round down, buddy, it's like, okay. So the Millennium Falcon actually did do the outrageous things. Han is actually that outrageous of a pilot. He is that good of a scoundrel, but he also has that moral compass that prevents him from running his own crime ring.
Kira is 100% right about Han. Compared to most of the people in this movie, he is a good guy.
Yeah.
So on that note, maybe we should talk about characters.
All right. So coming back for his second appearance is Weasel.
Who's Weasel?
Weasel is played by Warwick Davis, who is a longtime Star Wars actor because he is a little person. He also was in other Lucasfilm works, and he was a scum bounty hunter bad dude for Jabba the Hutt in Phantom Menace, but now he is a dude with a rocket launcher bigger than him who rides on the back of one of the Cloud Riders swoops.
Oh,
and we get to see him.
He went from hired hand to bike gangster. Cloud bike gangster.
And we also have Benthic Two Tubes, who is, this is his first appearance as one of the Cloud Riders.
Benthic Two Tubes.
We'll see him later.
Okay.
He's a tube guy.
If we're talking about notable, fun character appearances, I really liked Six Eyes in the Sabacc scene.
Yeah.
He's the guy who, like, keeps looking over at Han's cards, and Han's like, eyes on your hand, buddy. All of them. All six of them.
Now I've seen your cards. But in terms of real important characters, I think Dryden Voss is an interesting one to talk about a little bit more.
Ooh, you know, I didn't have a ton of notes about Dryden Voss. What did you think about him?
First of all, look up the Easter eggs for what's inside his office. He's got Mandalorian armor. He's got Exar Kun's tomb obsidian plate. He's got weird blades. He taught Kira Taras Kazi, which is the unarmed Sith art of dealing with people with lightsabers.
Whoa.
He's just full of Easter eggs, as well as he's got the golden idol and the crystal skull from Indiana Jones movies in his office.
That is super fun.
Also, he's a chump.
He is a chump. He's also, like, kind of majestic.
He's a majestic chump, but he lets himself get fooled by Kira, and it's kind of surprising. It makes you wonder how long she's been planning this.
I think it is not surprising if you go back to the first scene that Dryden and Kira have together when Han comes up with this desperate ploy to use unrefined coaxium, and how the way that Dryden relies on her so heavily throughout that entire scene, I think it is entirely predictable that she's the one who's able to slip his noose, to double-cross him. Mm. I am not surprised he doesn't see it coming. Because, and like, this is coming from some personal experience, people like Dryden Voss, who are so manipulative and so malicious and like to exert control over people, if you can make them feel good, they will come to rely on you. And then they won't see it coming, right? Like that's the chink in their armor.
Yeah.
And Kira is a mastermind at finding chinks in people's armor.
She is. So he's a chump, and he died like a chump.
I really like that little piece of dialogue where Han is trying to figure out, is Kira with Dryden? What is going on with Dryden? And she says, I'm not with him. I owe him.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me wonder what exactly Dryden got her out of that was such a bad situation.
Yeah. Well, doesn't matter now. She paid him back with interest. Let's talk about Han a little bit. Speaking of someone who's sussing everything out.
There is a little moment when he is leaning against the closet door. Kira's trying on Lando's ridiculous cape. And Han, like, puts his hand on his belt. And he's just, like, leaning. And he's smoldering at her. And I'm like, oh, I get it. He attractive, though. He cute, though. It was the first time I was like, okay, I get the Han thirst.
Mm-hmm.
I understand now.
Because he's a rogue. He's a scoundrel.
With that leather jacket.
And you want to, like, fix him, you know? You want to be like, oh, you're a good guy on the inside, though.
I will say I'm actively healing that part of myself that looks at damaged men and says, oh, I can fix them.
Yeah, don't do that.
I don't think Han at the beginning of this movie needed a lot of fixing. I think Han by the end of this movie has some trauma.
Yeah.
Everyone left him.
Except for Chewie. And Chewie stood by him. Chewie stood by him when they're escaping from Kessel. And that's like the last thing Kira says to him is, you're going to need Chewie and Chewie's going to need you.
I guess that was one of my big questions about Han and Chewie, because Chewie frees all of the enslaved Wookiees on Kessel, has an opportunity to go with them. And in that moment, when Han is in danger trying to rescue L3 and Lando, I think it makes sense for Chewie to go after Han and Lando and L3 and rescue them. I guess my lingering question was, why did Chewie stay with Han at the end of the movie?
So I think there's kind of two reasons there, and I've been been sitting on this for a little while. When L3 becomes the Millennium Falcon, when her brain becomes the Millennium Falcon's brain, she's a anarchist. She's a liberator. She is all about freedom. And Han is fundamentally a good guy on the inside. And he's always doing sketchy stuff because it's a really tough galaxy to be a good guy. But given different circumstances, he can cause a lot of good for a lot of people. And I think Chewbacca recognizes that he has more opportunities to do more good in the galaxy with Han.
Oh, interesting.
And he owes Han for freeing him from servitude as the Beast of Bimban.
Yeah, I can see that. I always thought that, I mean, people talk about the life debt between Han and Chewie, and I always thought that it was going to be more about freeing all of the Wookiees on Kessel, but Chewie does that by himself.
He kind of does, yeah.
Han was not participating in the side quest.
He was not, although he did get, he freed Chewbacca to begin with so that Chewbacca could do that.
I guess I just saw Han as this figure at the end of the movie who is Solo. He lost his father figure. Mm-hmm. He lost his girlfriend. And I kind of felt like Chewie was looking at him like, this guy has nobody and nothing. Mm-hmm. And I'm 190 years old and I've got a grandpa instinct, so I'm going to take him under my wing. But I was trying to search for more of like a friendship or mutuality there. And I'm just not sure that I saw it yet.
I think the biggest moment there is actually when they do the skid out to blow up the Thai brute behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And Han says, you know, when I say so, cut the thrusters, throw out the bilats, lower the landing gear. And then they do that. They're skidding along sideways on this asteroid. Han says, take it, she's yours. And then is flipping like 60 switches on his side. And then Chewbacca does the crazy flying. And then together they're like, nice flying. And I think Chewbacca is like, you don't get an opportunity to fly with someone who is this intentional, who is this much of a good reader, who is this good of a pilot often.
Ooh.
Han Solo is the only person who could have done that because he was sitting there. He tricked the Summa Verminoth into falling into the Maw. And then he's just got the cojones of steel to sit there and wait for the exact moment to fly it out. And then when they're escaping, when they do put the fuel in, they're flying through this closing canyon of presumably like condensed degenerate neutrons.
Korbenbergs or whatever.
Yeah. And it's closing and it's closing and it's closing. They flip the Millennium Falcon sideways, and then as they're going to light speed, the ship has to pause for a second. So they pause and then skip to light speed right as the cannon is closing. It's absolutely crazy.
It's truly thrilling. I'm sweating just thinking about it.
And you don't get to watching someone who has that level of skill in something makes you want to follow them.
Okay, I can totally see that. I like you filling in those details for me because one of my notes about this movie is that there are times when it really, really succeeds for a brand new fan like me. And there's times where it becomes a little bit more evident that this is fan service for veteran fans. So the two notes that I had about that were, one, why Chewie and Han stick together. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes perfect sense. And then the other one is that little conversation that Han has with Kira in the tent on Savareen when, you know, Han's saying, come with me. I'm not afraid of Crimson Dawn. I'm a big bad outlaw. And then Kira's like, you're not an outlaw. You're the good guy.
Yeah.
And that felt like it was going to be important later more than it felt like an actually earned characterization for Han. It felt like something that would make sense if you had watched the original trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't yet make sense to me as someone just watching Solo and meeting Han for the first time. I was like, is he a good guy?
So the argument about who Han Solo is has been ongoing for a long time throughout the original trilogy, because his whole thing in A New Hope is like, hey, I will rescue you as long as you pay me. And then he does, in fact, get paid, but comes back and saves the day at the end. And so his rebellious streak against everyone, against authority, his idea of really wanting to be solo, of wanting to be flying along and doing his own thing, gets caught up in just doing the right thing. And he's always putting off this exterior of someone who, of course, you can't control him. Of course, he is completely above and beyond any moral quandaries. You can't force him or manipulate him to do anything. But then people who are heroes or people who are villains like Kira can look at that and say, okay, I can trust you to always do the right thing. And that is a really interesting character to be. And this movie kind of puts paid to all the ideas and this argument of, like, is Han the kind of guy who shoots first? Is Han the kind of guy who doesn't shoot first? Is he the kind of guy who would do it just for the money? Is he the kind of guy who would do it because it's the right thing to do? And the answer is yes to all of it. Everything you've heard about him is true. He's a difficult man to understand.
He is opportunistic.
He is opportunistic. He's doing the right thing. His moral compass might be, like, really, really off kilter, but he does always end up doing the thing, and he just does it in a really sketchy manner.
Some of the producers and executive directors and art directors and whoever talked about the making of Han Solo as a character for this movie, and they said that Han represents rugged American exceptionalism. And I was like, first of all, yes. Mm-hmm. And second of all, yes. And also, I think it's really cool that, like, yes, Han ends up alone and is always, you know, he is often trying to get his cut of whatever is happening. Mm-hmm. But American exceptionalism is about exceptionalism. It's a fundamentally lonely thing. And at the end of this movie, I think we're teasing that Han isn't solo. He's got Chewie. Mm-hmm. And people, I think, who have more knowledge of Star Wars than me would say, and there are more people coming down the line for him in the future too.
Maybe. It's like he's the libertarian's ideal of a libertarian, someone who's, like, just in it for the money, but also has a moral compass and doesn't need anyone, but does have, like, a honest to God stapled at the shoulder babysitter for him. And, like, lives in a lawless land, but is protected by the law somewhat and is able to get themselves out of situations through fast talk.
It is
very much a masculine ideal to be Han Solo and to be able to talk yourself into and out of situations like this.
He cartwheels through the galaxy using what works for him and discarding what doesn't and causing chaos, but, like, has a heart of gold. And that's fun.
That's fun. He's a fun character.
I want to go back to something you said and switch gears a little bit, where you called Kira a villain.
Mm.
Do you think Kira's a villain?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Unpack. Tell me more.
I mean, she's working for Maul.
Is Maul a villain?
Yes.
Or is he an antagonist?
He's a villain. Maul's a bad dude. The last time we saw Maul before this is in season 7. Of the Clone Wars, and he rips a bunch of doors off the walls with the Force, holds them in front of him to deflect blaster shots, and then bisects a bunch of clone troopers with them. And then he leaves, and he's like, bye, Ahsoka, bye, Rex. I know you guys are cool, but I'm taking the one shuttle out of this exploding ship and just yeeting myself out. Maul has never been a good character. He was perfectly willing to sacrifice his brother, Savage.
Oh, I forgot about that. Well, I think he loved Savage and Palpatine picked on Savage because he was the weaker link.
Yes, but
sorry,
he was willing to sacrifice him.
That hits a really tender spot in my heart because I'm a big baby for Savage anyway.
And Maul is like, hey, so now that I've come out of my insane fugue state, it turns out the Clone Wars started as we planned out. As Sidious and I worked out over a couple bottles of Moof Milk in the freaking back room, I have been working for Sidious, and now we have this, like, very much enemies situation going on where we're trying to kill each other, but we're both bad guys. He's tried to kill all the good guys. Maul's a really bad dude, and he's running a massive crime syndicate, which Enfys Nest is like, yeah, this crime syndicate exists because they took over and destroyed the refining on this planet Savarin, moved around a bunch of refining, and so they killed this whole planet by taking out its refining capacity.
You're right. Looking at the Cloud Rider's existence and Enfys Nest's existence in reaction to just one crime syndicate kind of implies by proxy that because Maul is in charge of five crime syndicates, he's not a good guy. He's just such a good character.
Oh, absolutely. Like Kira.
Kira is fascinating. First thing, is she wearing one of Lando's capes when she does her little dress-up game on Kessel?
What else is she wearing?
He better let her keep it. It looks incredible on her. Oh, my goodness.
She is such a star on Kessel. She goes up, just calmly walks her way in, calmly disembowels a dude with his keys. Like,
it's like he killed a guy with a pencil in John Wick. Yeah, well, Kira did it. And we don't even see how.
It's off screen. She John Wick's a dude. And you're like, oh, boy.
It was enough for L3 to be like, you are not who I thought you were, lady.
L3 pauses and goes, whoa.
L3 was like, we just wore face masks and gossiped about boys. And this is a whole new side of you.
And then she was apparently packing thermal detonators in her other shoes. So she comes loaded for bear wherever she goes and makes a mess. And as they're leaving Kessel, and she claps her hands, she's like, come on, bus is leaving.
Iconic.
Stop playing it. Stop roughhousing. That is the reaction of someone who is not on their first rodeo.
Yes.
This is the kind of situation that she's like, oh, we're going and we're taking over a crime syndicate. Yeah, easy peasy. Put me alone with this dude and I'll leave my grenades in the locker. And they're like, what is the plan? And she's like, oh, no, that's the normal plan for taking down a crime syndicate. She's done this before.
I think Kira is so fun to watch. And I really like her relationship with Han because it's so layered, right?
Yeah.
I love watching Han and Kira interact with each other because from the very beginning on Corellia, Kira has always had this thing where Han yeets off and does whatever he does, and Kira picks up the pieces, right? Mm-hmm. She lets him go herring off to do whatever he wants. It seems like she does trust him to be a free agent, but she never trusts him to actually finish the job. And that is really fascinating to watch because she has a really good reason for that. Because he got her stuck on Corellia.
Yeah, this is true.
There is something between them where Kira knows that as good a guy as Han is, he cannot be trusted to finish the game.
And she has her own game. She recognizes that Han needs someone who's more supportive of him than she would be able to be.
Maybe. I'm actually thinking of even drop down Maslow's hierarchy of needs another level, drop down to level one, which is survival.
Yeah.
And Kira, I think, looks at Han and says, I can't guarantee that he would keep me alive because he flipped our speeder sideways and got us stuck in an alleyway. And that slowed us down enough that I got caught on my way off of Corellia. It makes sense that their failed escape on Corellia makes a relationship between them impossible because Kira's number one driving force is survival, and Kira will never trust him to help her survive ever again.
Yeah, she doesn't trust anyone to help her survive.
She only trusts herself.
And so she sets in place a coup to kill Dryden Vos because he holds something over her, and eventually, presumably, she'll set over a coup to try to topple Maul because she wants to control that. She can't get over the fact that everyone works for someone. She has had over the 3 years that are skipped over in this movie, something ground into her, which is this hierarchy of importance, of fear. And it's just a pure dark energy that inhabits her. But yeah, I'm calling her a villain. She's a great villain.
I'm calling her an oppositional force.
An antagonist?
An antagonist.
Okay.
And I'm completely biased. I'm not going to lie. I love a strong leading lady, and I love Emilia Clarke. And I love when we get female characters who are neither 100% good nor 100% bad. Remember when we watched the Night Sisters arc in season 3 of The Clone Wars? And I was like, I love that we're getting the strongest female characters in Star Wars ever, and I hate that they're baddies and it's hard to root for them. I think because Kira is rooting for herself, it makes it easier to root for her versus like the Night Sisters were causing just wanton chaos.
It's very funny to me how the Night Sisters as an idea have permeated so much of Star Wars. I recently read the book with the Night Sisters on it. It's The Courtship of Princess Leia. It led to the idea of the Night Sisters in the Clone Wars. And now we have like Maul exists because of the Night Sisters and Kira exists because of Maul. This relationship they all have interacting with each other as a planet of strong women who have just a completely different way of taking and living power from the universe. I think it's perhaps the George Lucas boomer era mentality of sort of a men are from Mars, women are from Venus, because the power structures of women in the Star Wars universe are completely different from the power structures that men inhabit.
Women in Star Wars generally, and I say this with like, this is a huge oversimplification. I mean, Ahsoka already disproves this. Most of the women in Star Wars seem to be in it for themselves and to survive in this incredibly harsh galaxy, whereas men seem to get more lateral motion to have a cause.
That is true for now. We're going to pivot off that pretty rapidly with newer stuff.
Okay, that's cool.
And the idea of following a cause, I mean, Enfys Nest is following a cause.
You're totally right.
And she picked up this mantle because it is her mother's mask. She was born into this lifestyle, but she carries on with this and has taken this because the Cloud Riders all take off their helmets to show that they're just regular people of all different species, that they're part of every one of us is from a world that the Empire or the Syndicates have devastated. Mm-hmm. So we pull together and we're not marauders. We're something much, much more. And I think that that just speaks to the desperation in the Star Wars universe. And maybe that's why Han Solo says no to joining the Rebels. He's desperate because he's down to the clothes on his back, whatever Chewbacca's wearing.
A bandolier
and one tiny container of coaxium. That's his entire life. He's on a planet he has no way off of. So they are absolutely down to nothing. And he's not that desperate yet.
And also, I think it's the size of the cause of Enfys Nest and the Cloud Riders. StarWars.com translate the inscription on Enfys's helmet, and it says, "Until we reach the last edge, the last opening, the last star, and can go no higher." Mm-hmm. And that's what she represents. And I think Han is like, I am not ready to throw myself into that. I am going to live a smaller game for a little while.
I've been trying to find when the movie first came out, or actually when the High Republic books first came out, people were like, oh, are the Cloud Riders related to the Nihil, who are the bad guys from the High Republic books? And it would have been really cool if yes, but it seems like so far no. And that's very sad because it would be cool if it was like a 1,000-year-old band of raiders who had like this beautiful lineage of chaos stretching back.
Ugh. Can you imagine the miniseries that would make?
But what's interesting is that the Cloud Riders themselves are from a 1977 comic book.
Ooh!
Like one of the very first Star Wars comic books from the first couple months of the Star Wars universe existing.
Wow!
And back then it was just like, oh, it's Hell's Angels, but in space, they're bad guys. But now this takes something with that incredible lineage and brings it forward, which is cool.
This just proves my theory that all the best stuff in the world is from the 70s. All of Dryden Voss's yacht goers were inspired by like 1970s editions of Vogue.
Oh, yeah. The lighting of this whole movie is fantastic.
Oh, my God. Can I tell you about it?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry. I really wanted to bring up this one little tidbit. The director of photography for this movie worked with Panavision to find old lenses, old camera lenses. And then he removed all the anti-glare coatings and he detuned them and he like scraped some stuff off and painted some new stuff on. And that's how he got the tone, the color tone of this movie. He used vintage camera lenses on a 2018 movie.
The lighting is fantastic. There's a moment right at the beginning of our watch today, right when they're taking off from Kessel. And with the explosions from Kira's pocket grenades going off, the ship lifts up out of this mining colony. The light comes on and you see like this burning glare come descend down the cockpit on top of Han's face and the smile on him. And you're like, okay, he's entering a brighter phase of his life.
Oh, I love it. Mm-hmm. Ah, it's so good.
It is really good. The lighting in Dryden Voss's is very like, it's what you imagine like a 70s Playboy mansion party to be.
Yes.
Just like, here are some extremely strange people and you could really make some enemies here. There's no room for screw ups, despite the fact that there is outrageous debauchery going on.
Mm-hmm. I don't have anything else except I think it's time for Baywatch.
Time for Baywatch.
I think it's time for Baywatch.
All right. Who's your bae for Solo Part 2?
Okay, so here's the thing. I'm going to pick one character from an iconic duo.
Okay.
I want to throw Baywatch out to both of them, but I will, in Baywatch tradition, lift one of them above the other. But my real true Baywatch is going to Lando and L3.
Oh, my.
They are so cute together.
They're very funny.
Lando does this thing where they're flying the Falcon together, and L3 is like, get your pinky on that button, Lando. And he says, whatever you say, my lady. Mm-hmm. He is such a simp for her, and I love it. Like, they have this little salute that they do when they, like, pushed into hyperspace together. And then L3 is like, Lando, my sacral circuit is sticking. You're going to have to do that thing again later. And Lando's like, I will do the thing for you. And I'm embarrassed that you said it out loud, but I'm still going to do it. And she's completely right. Lando loves her so much.
He does. Lando is someone who really, really appreciates life. He loves life. He loves deeply. He loves long. He loves hard. And he gets to. And being just in Lando's orbit seems outrageously fun.
Yes. I think you have mistaken me. Lando's not my bae.
Ah, ha, ha,
it's L3 forever.
That's so funny. You got me.
It's L337. She is elite in leap speak. She's elite in my heart. She so passionately believed in revolution that she died for her cause. And she will now be part of Star Wars legends and canon forever.
Yeah, because now she's part of the Millennium Falcon.
It's totally L3.
And also one of our biggest advocates for droid rights.
So yes.
Listen to our backlog to see how we feel about droid rights.
You can go back to season one, episode like 7 of the Clone Wars with the R2 evil droid
arc.
And we champion droid rights. And L3 was there all along. Mm-hmm. Anyway, who's your bae?
I'm going with another half of another iconic duo. I'm going for Han Solo.
Han Schmolo.
Apparently, I once again get the disapproval from the peanut gallery
womp,
here.
Womp.
Might as well have chosen Dryden Voss.
No, I like Han. He's shiny and bright. What do you like about him?
I like that he's shiny and bright. I like that Han shows up, especially in the second half of this movie, once he's in the pilot seat of the Millennium Falcon and he's flying around, there is no doubt whatsoever in his mind that things are going to be okay. He knows exactly where everything is. He exudes, he speaks into being. He makes that ship sing. And everyone knows it. And it's amazing.
He does have this relentless optimism that's like a gravitational pull. He's like, I've got a great feeling about this. And then he just makes it great.
And his plans are absolutely ludicrous, but he's like, okay, no one's ever made the Kessel Run in less than 20 parsecs. We got to do it faster. I'll make a shortcut. And they're like, you can't make a shortcut. He's like, look, I've already started. Like, we don't have time to say no. We have to keep pushing forward. We got to fail forward. We got to succeed forward. We got to keep moving.
Yeah.
Because otherwise they'll catch us.
Yeah. It's kind of exhausting, I think, in some circumstances to watch a character like that. Mm-hmm. But Han just gives it this energy and this brightness. And yeah, he's just got this big smile at life in this movie. And I love that.
Yeah. And despite his noticeable trauma, early on in this half, we talk about Corellian Engineering and his dad.
Yeah.
Never talk about his mom.
Lando talks about his mom. She's the most amazing woman he's ever known. And yep. Now I want a Lando's mom spinoff. Anyway, yeah, Han.
But Han, you know, was on the streets for years, presumably by age 10 or whatever. And he's incredibly damaged. He has a grade school education or whatever, and is still brilliant at the things he chooses to be brilliant at. And he can still really make something happen. And I think that that is just so cool. It is the American exceptionalism. It is the masculine ideal of a particular era to be self-made, put it all on the line, reap your reward, make it happen, turn what's in your pocket into a life, into a career. It's inspiring. And it's also fiction. But it is a way to tell this story. And I think that the Han Solo story, the Solo story, is one of this, like, idealized masculinity.
Just because it's fiction doesn't mean that it can't influence reality either.
Yeah, exactly.
The reason we tell stories is to learn different ways to be. So I think if Han inspires people to inhabit this form of masculinity that they really admire, they will then turn that into reality. That's why stories are important. Mm-hmm. That's why having great characters is important.
And so one particular aspect of it, I think, embodies positive masculinity, non-toxic masculinity, which is both the planning phase when he says, okay, that's not going to work. What's next? That's not going to work. What's next? Just this, let's make something happen. Like, we don't necessarily need to pick at every single thread. We need to make a skeleton so we can get some motion here. Because once we have something that sounds good to everyone, then we can flesh out the rest of it and make a body. But like, we're brainstorming.
Han Solo knows how to prioritize.
Exactly. And that's he brings young dad energy into the Star Wars universe in a way that, like, Hunter does as well, you know?
And he's even got a minivan and a co-pilot.
He does. So it's Han for me.
Oh, I love that. And nothing for Tobias Beckett. Goodbye.
So join us next week. We finished Solo. We're doing another time skip a little bit forward. We are going to be joined by Kathleen from FSF Popcast for the imaginatively named Part 1 of Kenobi.
Obi-Wan Kenobi Part 1. Oh, we haven't seen him in a while.
We haven't. It's really easy to keep track of the names in the Kenobi series. So after Part 1, we'll do Part 2.
Will we do Part 3 after
we will.
That?
We
wow.
Will, yeah.
And then Part 4?
Yeah.
Oh, I never could have guessed. If you love Growing Up Skywalker, you can follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Mastodon. We are also doing some really fun things on the Patreon. You can become a monthly member for as little as $3 a month. We're watching the Tartakovsky Clone Wars, and we just did a review of a new Star Wars deck building game, which is, spoiler alert, very delightful.
That's just because you beat me at it every time. Well, I demand a rematch.
Okay.
And this time I'm taking that little green Psylocke too.
And send this episode to someone who inspires you to fail forward.
Send this episode to someone who is fully self-assured in who they are, and you see that and you perceive that.
And I hope you're perceiving yourself, because that's how great you are.
Yeah.
And we'll see you next Tuesday.
Bye-bye.